You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24. I'm Emma Nelson. In today's programme, can Apple take on the textbook? The computer giant unveils a new device to reinvent the way we learn. Our New York editor, Aisha Spears, crosses the pond to bring us the latest from Paris Fashion Week.
There's less of the kind of old school, old family vibe here, so you've also got a lot of the youngest labels are showing.
We'll also be getting a design update with Hugo McDonald from Zurich, and we'll ask what exactly a leap second is and whether we really need one. All that packed into the next 60 minutes here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. But before all that, here's Nick Kelly with the latest from around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Iran's Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Salehi, on a visit to Turkey, has warned Arab neighbours against aligning themselves too closely with the United States. Iran has threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz, used for a third of the world's seaborne oil trade, if pending Western moves to ban Iranian crude exports cripple its lifeblood energy sector. The dispute is fanning fears of a descent into a wider Middle East war. Salehi said that Iran was in touch with world powers to reopen talks that he expected to be held soon.
Our position is that the U.S. has first to show that they are ready for any precondition negotiation on equal par.
And Mr. Salehi said all sides are willing to resume negotiations to defuse a brewing crisis over Iran's nuclear program, but the time and place needed to be settled. Syrian forces have retreated from a rebel-held town under a local ceasefire, but deadly violence raged on elsewhere as a month-long mandate for Arab peace monitors in Syria was expiring. 20 people were reported killed, adding to a death toll of more than 600 since the monitors arrived in Syria, where an insurgency is hardening what began as a mostly peaceful struggle against President Bashar al-Assad's authoritarian rule. A suicide bomber has killed 7 civilians, including 2 children, and wounded 8 in an attack on the main gate of the Kandahar airfield used by international and Afghan troops in southern Afghanistan. Despite the presence of more than 100,000 foreign troops, violence across Afghanistan remains at its worst level since the Taliban were toppled by US-backed Afghan forces in late 2001. Recovery teams working on the capsized Italian liner are racing against the clock to complete the search for victims of the disaster before the weather turns and salvage crews need to start pumping fuel from the wreck. One of the specialist diving crews said today the available window could be as small as 12 to 24 hours, although the chief spokesman of the rescue services denied that any deadline had been set and said the situation was still evolving. The Texas governor, Rick Perry, has dropped out of the race of the 2012 Republican U.S. presidential nomination after a series of gaffes and controversies undercut the campaign of the one-time frontrunner. He endorsed the former rival, Newt Gingrich. Perry entered the race in August and briefly was at the front of the pack of Republican candidates, but a series of lackluster debate performances and controversial statements during the campaign undermined his standing in the polls. Thousands of Romanian opposition supporters rallied in Bucharest today to demand the government's resignation following a week of separate anti-austerity protests across the country, which have sometimes turned violent. Police said about 7,000 people took part in the rally, organised by the leftist opposition USL, to press for the resignation of the Prime Minister Emil Boc's centrist coalition and his ally President Traian Băsescu. And people in China are on the move over the next 4 days, with some travelling thousands of kilometres just to get home for the new year. It's thought some 3 billion separate journeys will be made. For some, though, it seems to have brought anxiety and frustration.
I queued for 5 hours and I ended up with a standing-only ticket. There were no seats left. Everyone had bought them online, but I don't know how to do that.
You definitely have to go home for the Spring Festival. I think that goes for all Chinese people. It doesn't matter where you are, you just have to go home for the new year.
The perils of travelling home for the new year in China. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. Time now for a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernecker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel. And the weather in most of Europe has become much milder, but wetter, especially in the UK, France and Germany. Even in Eastern Europe, temperatures have risen, and it's generally only below freezing during the night. However, it's still cold enough for some snow in cities like Warsaw or Kiev. Certainly cold enough for snow in alpine resorts. In St. Moritz, about half a metre of fresh snow over the next few days. Similar amounts for Chamonix. Zermatt, a little less snowy, but still on the cold side. It's Friday's City Outlook. London 9 Celsius, partly cloudy. Berlin 4 degrees and rain. Stockholm 0 Celsius, partly cloudy here. In Athens 14 Celsius and sunny. North America now. Lovely weather across the eastern US seaboard from Miami to Washington. Perhaps a few snow flurries in New York City Thursday night local time, but other than that, the weather's looking good for the end of the week. In eastern Canada, in Montreal, frigid here. Night temperatures around minus 18 degrees. On the Pacific side of the US, however, winter weather, rain, snow, and ice. Here's Friday's city forecast. In New York City, 2 Celsius and sunny. Detroit, minus 4 with snow flurries. Seattle, 6 degrees and the snow turns to rain. In Los Angeles, 19 degrees with just partly cloudy skies. On to other world destinations for the next 48 hours. In Japan, if you're off to Tokyo, the weather end of the week and the weekend is looking pretty wet. Cold with highs only around 6 degrees. Similar weather for Osaka. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Thomas. It's 6 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24 and you're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Ein Monocle 24 lagert, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei oikeassa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Apple turned its attention to the textbook today. iBooks 2 is Apple's take on revolutionising the teacher-pupil relationship. It's designed for the iPad 2, but unlike an app, iBooks 2 takes the textbook and makes it interactive. With 1.5 million iPads already being used in schools and universities, could this mark the beginning of the end of the printed word? Well, to explain everything is a technology journalist David Phelan, who I'm delighted to say joins us in the studio at Midori House now. A very warm welcome to the programme, David.
Thank you.
Explain to us, in possibly a slightly better way than I have just done, what iBooks 2 is.
No, I think you've explained it really well. Steve Jobs, we know from the biography that came out last year, was very keen on doing something about educational textbooks. He felt that it was something that was out of date, that wasn't useful, and could be redesigned in a modern way. It was the next industry he wanted to address, we think. And so this isn't entirely unexpected, this announcement today, and it's exactly as you say, it's to try and persuade people to move on from books and to have interactive books on their iPads.
Who is it aimed at?
Well, it's certainly aimed at... There were two announcements today, iBooks 2, and iBooks Author, which is a program to help people to create interactive ebooks in a very simple, straightforward and accessible way. So that's part of whom that's aimed at. And then iBooks itself is aimed at schools who want to, instead of having tattered, dog-eared textbooks to hand on from year to year, can have pristine digital editions which individual students can highlight and use as they wish, but that won't affect the next user.
But it wouldn't just work as a textbook, though. I mean, you imagine you're the teacher and I'm the pupil. This would have a really quite profoundly interactive element to it, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think on every level. It can have video, it can have interactive elements. One of the things they showed at the event today was a 3D element on a page which could be spun and twisted and seen from every angle, which obviously you can't do with paper. And so the idea is that it will have much greater flexibility and interactivity.
And a teacher can also set out homework or tasks and what have you and then instantly mark and give instant feedback to the pupil.
Yes, and indeed you can have, in a textbook, you might have a quiz at the end of a chapter or to check that a student had learnt things. Now you'll be able to have that same questionnaire, but it can have multiple choice answers which the student can fill in, and then the book itself can mark them.
In many ways, this can fundamentally alter the teacher-pupil relationship, not just in terms of the fact that the feedback can be instantaneous and the tests can be instantaneous, but the essence of classroom learning has been one teacher, many pupils, and the interaction among pupils. What was the reaction to potential change to that?
I think it was definitely welcomed. It's seen it as a very exciting development, but obviously there's a lot of questions which, because it only was announced today, haven't yet been answered. For example, although the books themselves will be, in comparison to textbooks, considerably cheaper, $15 in the States, you do have to factor in the cost of the iPad as well. And not everyone will feel that they want to spend an iPad on their child. And the other thing is that although they said that books aren't very durable, and it's true they don't last decades, if you drop an iPad, you may not be able to pick it up and use it, but you can with a book.
Or a book's battery will never run out.
Well, yes, that's right. That's a great thing about a book.
And there's also a general reluctance, I would imagine, to lend your iPad to your friend who has forgotten to bring their iPad in, or it sort of almost removes the communal aspect of learning.
I think it can add to it in another way, but I think that something that parents may be concerned about is that when a student is using an iPad in a class, there's nothing to stop them from actually surf the net and do something else, or even play Angry Birds when they should be.
Well, who wouldn't? If only I was given the opportunity in my physics lessons. There was this great thing about Steve Jobs had a tremendous enthusiasm for education. Is this a direct product of the Jobs legacy, or has this? Are there sort of clues that there have been little tweaks and additions made to it?
Yeah, I think I would guess it's a pretty direct thing because they've clearly been working with the major publishers, Pearson, McGraw-Hill, and a couple of others were the ones I mentioned today, and those negotiations happen over months and years. So for sure, this is exactly the direction that Steve Jobs would have been heading it in.
Would it just be an exclusive Apple product? Because that introduces all manner of branding and sort of the financial element into what effectively learning should be a sort of an equal opportunities business.
Sure.
You've read about, I don't know if you've read about the No, that's raising more money to build this dual tablet which has a complete pupil's desk on it.
Sure.
Is there going to be a race to get all these new products out, or is Apple ahead of the game?
I think Apple is definitely ahead of the game. And I think you raise an interesting point, because for sure, Apple is encouraging people to write interactive educational books for its platform, for the iPad, and you're not going to easily necessarily be able to put it on the No or on any other tablet. Apple has always maintained that the walled garden that they have is there to protect consumers so that they get the best experience, because every part of the product works with the other part. There's no software from one company that has to work on multiple pieces of hardware. Apple makes sure it all works together.
Nonetheless, as we've seen things with iTunes, musicians trying to get their music onto iTunes has often been quite a difficult task. Will publishers feel trapped, or will reluctant to sign up to Apple, and therefore find themselves out of a market which they could obviously contribute to academically?
Sure. Well, again, they stress that the publishers they've been talking to are responsible for about 90% of US textbooks. So I think Apple would say that they're making sure that everyone is involved. Plus, the iBooks author program seems to be a way for anyone to write a book, not just a textbook, but to create a beautifully designed book and publish it very easily on the iBook store.
This is this is the first time since Steve Jobs' death that there's been a big announcement about a big new product. What was the general reaction? What's the feeling to the fact that this is possibly the beginning of a new era?
Yeah, sure. I think, in a way, I think that has happened already. I think it happened on the last keynote, was given by Tim Cook on the iPhone 4S the day before Steve Jobs died. But that already had a sense that Steve Jobs was in the background or not involved. And this felt very much, from the keynotes that I've seen given by Phil Schiller in the past, this felt very much the same style of presentation as before.
So how is Tim Cook doing as CEO as he stepped out of the shadows of Steve Jobs?
Well, it's a heck of a shadow to step out from, but I think his job in the past has been more key and more crucial than we have known. And suddenly he seems to be less eager to be in the spotlight. And certainly he wasn't on view today. Phil Schiller, as I say, presented today. But I think I've no doubt he's working his magic behind the scenes.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. David Phelan, the technology journalist, thank you very much indeed. It's 15 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24. Time now for some music on Midori House. This is Wahida by Jesus Acosta and the Professionals. And that was Wahida by Jesus Acosta and the Professionals. It's 18 minutes past the hour here on Midori House. Coming up in a moment, we'll be taking front row at Paris Fashion Week.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
Paris Men's Fashion Week got underway today. Hot foot from the Milan shows, our very own Aisha Spears has thrown herself in the direction of the Paris catwalk just to make sure that Monocle doesn't miss a turn. While she took a quick breather in a cafe in the Marais, I caught her for a quick chat, and I started by asking her that although she'd only just arrived, if she could tell me what the atmosphere in Paris was like.
Well, Paris itself is quite rainy, a little bit drizzly and grey. It feels a little bit like traditional London weather, but the atmosphere is good. We've seen one show today. We went to Louis Vuitton at 2:30, which was in this amazing kind of glass cube thing, which they've been showing in for the last couple of seasons. And it was way out, kind of on the outskirts of central Paris. And it was a great show, actually. It was Kim Jones' second season, lots of tailoring, quite wearable tailoring, some nice pieces, which hopefully I can maybe try and find a likeliness of for women.
What's the overwhelming patterns and colours and seasons? Because I know that everyone's trying to work out how to wear pastels this season, which frankly fills certain people in certain quarters with absolute horror.
I think we saw a lot of tailoring in Milan, which we expect, because, you know, Milan is the home of good tailoring. And then, you know, we talked this afternoon, there was a lot of tailoring too. We talked on a show last week, actually, about Susie Menk's article saying that tailoring really is a good sign of the times, because it's kind of showing men, I guess, coming back to a new formalism, and even despite the recession that people are feeling. So, you know, there was a lot of suits, and it was great. It looked really good. The show was packed, which was also a nice thing to see.
When you say that the show was packed, did we have that traditional front row of inappropriately invited celebrities?
No, sadly. Well, I mean, sadly for, I think, the gossip papers, probably quite nicely for us. Last season, for men, here in Paris in June, that Kanye was on the front row of Louis Vuitton. A basketball player called Dwayne Wade was also on the front row. And I think that because it's basketball season, he couldn't be here. And I'm not sure where Kanye is, but this season it very much felt like just the editors and the buyers were on the front row. It might have something to do with the fact that it's winter in Paris and not so glamorous for celebs to descend upon the city.
So you just said you come from Milan and you're fresh into Paris. What differences have you spotted between the two places?
I think Milan seems always has felt a little bit more serious, in a sense. It's kind of run by families, a lot of the Milanese labels, and it's a manufacturing centre for a lot of fashion. So you've got a sense that even the people attend the shows are more suited and booted. Whereas here in Paris, you've got a lot of the big names, like Hermes, who we're seeing later on, obviously Louis Vuitton, who we saw earlier on today, Dries Van Noten, who we're seeing in a couple of hours, but there's less of the kind of old school, old family vibe here. So you've also got a lot of the youngest labels who are showing, and there are trade shows here, whereas in Milan, the trade show happens in Florence a couple of days before Milan starts. So here you've got a lot more celebs and a lot more people standing outside trying to get into the shows. And the vibe is more, it feels younger, it feels a bit more fresh than Milan, but I actually prefer Milan because it's more of the business side over there.
Has anybody given any inkling about who's going to take over at Dior, or is that still the question that no one wants to ask or answer?
Well, I mean, everyone's saying it's going to be Raf Simons. He's going to be moving from Jill Sander. But then there's also, you know, I don't know. Who knows if Marc Jacobs would go there? But word on the street is it's Raf, so they're going to find someone to take over at Jill Sander.
Speaking of words and streets, where are you? It sounds beautifully busy and very, very French.
I am in the Marais, which you know well, I think, Emma.
I do.
In Café Charlot, which is on the corner of Rue de Bretagne and Rue Charlot. And I'm just having a coca light before... going over to the Grand Palais to see the Dries show.
Oh, that would be on the would that be on the line one, on the metro?
I don't even know what line it is. Oh, where am I now?
Yes.
I got off at Republique and
yes.
Then I walked down. So
oh, lovely.
I think that's many lines. Yeah, the purple one.
Oh, that used to be my line. That's line eight.
That's line eight. It is line eight. You're right. I got off at Republique at line eight and walked down here. So I actually love the Paris Metro. I think it's such a well-done thing, and so I love taking it. But it is raining, and we have to get to the show, so I might try and find a Paris taxi.
I was about to say, how do you arrive at a Paris show without giving the impression that you've just leapt off a metro? You can't be giving the impression that you've slummed it at all, can you?
I don't mind. I'm quite happy to look like I've slummed it. I'm not really there. You know, we're there to see, you know, support signs that we like. We're not really there to kind of look like I'm... you know, good enough to be in the show. You know, we're there to watch the show. It's business, and it's. I'm quite happy to take the metro. I think it's sometimes a lot more efficient to take the metro, both in Milan and in Paris. In Paris last summer, Taki and I actually rented the Vélib bicycles and went to some appointments and shows via those. It was a great way to get around the city.
Oh, it's a fantastic way. You just arrive a little bit warmer than you might want to.
Exactly, with windswept hair, which I'm sure is what some of the looks are trying to achieve anyway.
Aisha, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
You're welcome. Have fun. I'll speak to you soon.
And that was Aisha Spears just before she hot-footed off to the next show at Paris Men's Fashion Week. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, where it's now time for a song. We know it's Thursday, but we couldn't wait. This is Friday Fashion by Ricky Tick Big Band. Ricky Tick Big Band on Monocle 24 and Friday Fashion. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be finding out what tickled our design editor's fancy in Zurich, and we'll be rethinking the concept of time, all light-hearted stuff. But before all that, here's Nick Kelly with the latest news headlines.
Thanks, Emma. Iran's foreign minister has warned Arab countries not to put themselves in a dangerous position by aligning themselves too closely with the United States in the escalating dispute over Tehran's nuclear activity. Syrian forces have retreated from a rebel-held town under a local ceasefire, but deadly violence raged on elsewhere as a month-long mandate for Arab peace monitors in Syria was expiring. A suicide bomber has killed 7 civilians, including 2 children, and wounded 8 in an attack on the main gate of the Kandahar airfield used by international and Afghan troops in southern Afghanistan. A bomb blast has killed 2 Somali policemen and 4 refugees close to a camp for displaced people in the capital, Mogadishu. Recovery teams working on the capsized Italian liner are racing against the clock to complete the search for victims of the disaster before the weather turns and salvage crews need to start pumping fuel from the wreck. The Texas governor, Rick Perry, has dropped out of the race for the 2012 Republican U.S. presidential nomination after a series of gaffes and controversies undercut the campaign of the one-time front-runner. BP is likely to agree next month to pay $20 to $25 billion to settle all charges around the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, according to a leading analyst, double the figure the company has set aside, and more than other analysts expect. Nigeria has discovered a huge discrepancy in the amount of the motor fuel it subsidises and what people actually consume. A legislative committee said supporting the idea that a government scheme to make petrol cheaper is wasteful and corrupt. Thousands of Romanian opposition supporters rallied in Bucharest today to demand the government's resignation, following a week of separate anti-austerity protests across the country, which have sometimes turned violent. And one of the most common sources of computer intrusions has stopped infecting new machines, after security researchers working with Facebook released the names of five suspected ringleaders. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. And Nick will be back in a little under half an hour with a full update on all the world headlines. Time now for our weekly design update. And today, Hugo MacDonald is in Zurich. On Tuesday's Midori House, which was broadcast live from the Swiss city, we heard from the local business owner, Sebastian Fadatz, who spoke about his clothing and accessories store, Townhouse. Well, as he was in town, Hugo decided to pop along to the shop to find out more about their approach to product design and to see some of their favourite items up close.
Hello. Good morning. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Not at all. I can't wait to see it. I'm here in Zurich in Townhouse with Sebastian and Mia.
We started 3 years ago. We come from a business background. Mia was in marketing and I did consulting. And then we decided really to, you know, focus on what we really love to do, connect with people and also find the what we think are the best products all over the world. So we really going through all the countries looking for small manufacturers that still produce special products.
We heard from Sebastian on Midori House on Tuesday, and I thought maybe for Midori House today it would be nice to pop down and hear from them both about a couple of the products that they have been working with small producers that are sort of at the centre of Townhouse brand and what they stand for. So Sebastian, maybe you could start by picking something that is a product really at the centre of Townhouse.
One of those is this lighter. I can maybe show the effect. It's made by a very old company in Austria. It's close to Vienna. And the special thing about this lighter that it has unchanged design for roughly 100 years. So they started even before the World Wars with made out of scrap metal, basically, and empty bullet shells, and they still produce it in like an unchanged design. And this is one of our all-time favorites.
And this is a little company that only makes these.
Exactly, exactly. They just make lighters. That's about it.
And it's clever because although it's a lighter that you flick down, you can pull the bottom of it out as well, so it becomes like a candle lighter
exactly,
too. It's fantastic and also very affordable.
Absolutely. It's 12.90 Swiss francs, so that's a good price for such a designy old product.
And something like this is sold throughout Austria, but they don't, I mean, presumably the company doesn't have the marketing or resources to sort of sell it to a more design savvy consumer, is that right? And is that sort of your mission to introduce something like this to a wider audience?
I think so. I think the thing with this kind of products is that even in Austria, it's hidden somewhere at like tobacco shops among, you know, 200 different lighters. And I think this is also the concept of our store, that we just look for one lighter, which we think is the best lighter. And then it can stand out a little bit.
Fantastic.
And the company who produces them, they have also a larger selection of lighters. So they themselves have like, I don't know, 20 or 30 different products. But we really try to pick up one style and one product that we believe is the best. And that's this one.
And you also, I think you said 50% of the things that you stock here in Townhouse are collaborations with small producers that you've met. And I see these Teflon wash bags over here. Maybe we could talk about those. What was this building originally?
It's a very old building. It dates back to the 9th century and used to be a non-monastery, actually. So behind the walls, behind the covering, you have like really, really old cobblestones still visible from like the old structure.
I love it. And these beams are original too, are they?
Yes, they are, but I think the problem with this kind of old buildings is that the materials got recycled
right
over the centuries, so you don't really know when those beans came in because they reused the material which I just found here.
Okay. Well, they look nice enough anyway. So these are the Teflon wash bags. This is quite a technical fabric, isn't it?
Exactly. It's a German engineered fabric, and they use it for outdoor products usually. So you find it for those umbrellas you find outdoors, etc. And we took it and we thought it would be a good idea to make wash bags out of it because it's water repellent and also UV resistant. And we make them, they're handmade in Switzerland, and they come in different colors. And it's just a fun product that men like to use when they go traveling for the weekend.
Oh, you can never have too many wash bags.
Exactly.
And I mean, you stock a whole range of things. You've worked with a French candle producer as well.
Exactly.
And I see there are some lovely fashion items too. These beautiful jumpers and socks and scarves. And some Japanese glue. But what are these elephants here, which are very cute?
It was actually one of the first townhouse products we developed. I think it's been in the shop since day one, and it's become like a shop mascotchen, you say in German. I don't know. It's like
a mascot.
Exactly. And it was designed by a Swiss artist. Well, artist maybe is the wrong word. He's actually a
craftsman.
Yes, also based in Zurich, and also the special thing about the elephants that are really made maybe, I think, a kilometer apart from here.
Does the elephant have a name?
No. It's just a townhouse elephant. But it was funny, when we opened the shop, we put like 20 of them in the window display, and then we became the shop with the elephant.
So it really is a mascot.
Exactly.
Wonderful. And how many products in total do you stock then?
Oof, that's a tough question.
Sorry, I've put you on the spot. How well do you know your own business?
A lot. No, but we change our range, like in comparison to other shops, we don't change like the range twice a year completely, but we have like new things coming in every week, so that's...
December, you opened a men's store, just not far from here.
Mm-hmm.
And the men's store is more of a sort of focused on fashion, is that right?
Exactly. It's called Pelicamo. It's 10 minutes by foot from townhouse. And we have everything that a man needs in his daily life. So we have suits, shirts, shoes, bags, but we also have like some fun products, like we have our in-house bicycle. We have an own whiskey we produced in Switzerland.
Oh, fantastic. And this, I mean, townhouse together with the men's store, sort of quite unusual in the Zurich retail scene, but the response has been fantastic, I gather.
It's been a fun 3 years. We opened the townhouse 3 years ago, so it's been a fun ride. But we saw that when we did townhouse that we have a lot of men coming buying our basic sweaters and socks and boxer shorts. And so we saw that the demand was here for a new men's shop.
And that was Monocle's design editor, Hugo McDonald, talking to Sebastian Fadatz and Mia Zeltner, who are the owners of Zurich's townhouse store. I'm happy to say I'm joined in the studio by our producer, Katie Bilboa, who has literally got off a plane from Zurich. You recorded that thing with Hugo this morning, didn't you?
I did, and it's quite funny because it sounds a little bit, if you listen, like Hugo's walking around in a pair of Cuban heels, but they were actually my shoes. You could hear clip-clopping across the floor.
There was a clip-clop. There's a very strong clip-clop element to that. The reason why we've called you in is because it sounded like a very unique little shop. And you said you were talking to me just a moment ago by saying it feels very different and you really enjoyed being in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really lovely space. It's not very big, but they've taken real care to kind of select specific products that they've sourced, you know, from specific places. And it's just something really nice about the way they've taken the care to find the things they want and set up a shop that is its own brand. So they're producing, you know, tailored products that they've decided they want to make.
And how does it stand out from the other shops in Zurich?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of retail in Zurich and there's a lot of high-end retail. But I guess what's nice about this is, it's a small kind of family-run business, it feels like. And like I said, you know, the way they've just found products that they've, you know, they know where everything comes from. They know exactly, and it's all kind of made locally where possible. And they know the specific people and, you know, they've chosen specific fabrics for specific products and all that kind of thing.
And clearly a pair who get on very well, who work very well together.
Yeah, they are so lovely as well. Hugo and I basically didn't want to leave when we had to go because I had to go and catch my flight. And we came out of the shop and we both looked at each other and said, can't we just stay here and work with them?
You have influence their design, though, with the elephant. There was mention in that report there about an elephant.
Oh, yeah. So just after we stopped recording, Sebastian said, I think Hugo is a good name for an elephant. So I think the elephant is now called Hugo.
That's lovely.
So he's left his mark, even though we had to physically leave.
Even though he clip-clocked with his Cuban heels around the shop.
Yeah.
Katie Bilbao, thank you very much indeed. It's 19 minutes at the top of the hour here on Midori House. Time now for some music and Swoon by Imogen Heap. That was Imogen Heap and Swoon. Coming up next on Midori House, a brief reassessment of time.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In affairs and business, there's a bit of an oil theme. We head to Accra to find out whether Ghana can escape the oil curse that has blighted its neighbours. And we visit Santos, the Brazilian city that's using its oil profits to give Sao Paulo a run for its money.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Time now on Midori House to talk time. Just a small topic, some may say, but not something we're scared to take on here. Today, a group with similar ambitions met in Geneva to discuss whether leap seconds should be abolished. You may be wondering what on earth a leap second is. Well, when the Earth rotates, it can actually take a few milliseconds more or less than the 24 hours we have in a day. So, in order to keep atomic clocks in time with the Earth's rotation, every few years an extra second is added on. The argument goes that without this extra second, over a long period of time, day and night would start happening at the wrong points. So why do some scientists think that this should be abolished? And what, if anything, could it be replaced with? Well, to answer some of those rather meaty questions, joining us now on the line is Vincent Mietz, who's chairman of the International Telecommunication Union's study group, who are currently organising this event in Geneva. A very warm welcome, Vincent. Just explain to us very quickly about what your group actually does.
Well, good evening. My group is actually dealing with all the scientific issues within the International Telecommunication Union. And among the scientific issues, we were dealing with the time distribution, and the leap second was one of the major subjects that we were studying in the last years. We've been studying that since 2004 up to today.
The leap second sounds like a reasonably vital bit of time, which stops us from having night at the wrong time and day at the wrong time. What's the argument, if you could say it as simply as possible, please, to abolish it?
Well, actually, when you have a leap second, it means that you have to insert an extra second in all the systems that are using time. And there are a lot of systems today that are synchronized with time. All the telecommunication systems, the navigation systems, they are synchronized with very precise clocks, and they're using the UTC, the Universal Time Coordinated, but they have to insert that leap second. When that happens, the problem is if you insert the leap seconds, then you have to test the program afterwards to make sure that you insert it correctly, you didn't do any mistakes, and you won't have your telecommunication network going down, or you won't have your satellite put in the wrong orbit. So it's something that needs to be done. If you don't have any leap seconds, then you won't have this problem, so it will be less of a burden on all the system using precise time.
So it's actually more a practical solution to stop people making mistakes with time than actually an issue to do with time itself.
Yeah, it's really a practical solution. But on the other hand, it has to do with time as well, because if you don't enter these leap seconds, you will have a drift from the time that is based on the rotation of the Earth and the time that is based on the atomic clock. Today, the difference between the atomic clock and the time based on the rotation of the Earth is about 34 seconds. But it's adjusted every 2, 3, 4 years, it depends on how the Earth rotates. But it's adjusted with the leap second. So the UTC never have a difference of more than 0.9 seconds. But obviously, if we don't have this leap second, in 2100, we may have a difference between the time based on the rotation and the time on your watch, and in the order of 2 minutes, for instance, and it's probably in the order of something like 30 minutes in the year 2700.
So it's, you know, we're talking the long view here, but nonetheless, this could fundamentally alter the way that our lives operate. Surely, by doing this, by taking away this leap second, which has obviously filled a gap, time is suddenly becomes based on man's measurements, on man's atomic clocks, and completely sort of splits itself off with how the Earth operates.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the problems that the administration were facing here in the ITU, that time has always been based on the observation of the sun for the last 5,000 years. And here it's a different thing of having the time only based on the atomic clock. But obviously, it doesn't change the duration of the day if we have atomic clock or if we have the time based on the rotation of the Earth. It's just that because the Earth is not rotating constantly, you know, sometimes we have events such as earthquakes and volcanic activity that are going to slow down or to make the Earth rotate quicker. So because of that, the duration of time is not exactly the same if you take the Earth as a clock, if you will. So you have to adjust that by a second sometimes every year, sometimes every 3-4 years. It all depends because it's not predictable.
Vincent Means, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Vincent Means, who's chairman of the International Telecommunication Union Study Group, who's talking about what we'll do when we lose the leap second. It's 8 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House. Now, the Middle East has continued to dominate the news agenda around the world in recent years, and with the fallout from the Arab Spring still resonating and the governments of Syria and Iran continuing to provoke controversy, it looks like the region will remain in the spotlight for the forthcoming year. The London-based artist John Keane has been inspired by these regional events, including former British Prime Minister Tony Blair's mercurial appearance at the Chilcot Inquiry. His show, Scratching the Surface, Joining to Dots, has just opened at the Flowers Gallery in London. Monocle's Jack Phillips went down there to meet him and find out more.
The British painter John Keane gained national acclaim as the official artist for the Imperial War Museum during the Gulf War in the early 90s. With some 20 years' experience in the Middle East as a roving practitioner, it's no surprise that his work is both highly politicised and densely image-based. His work is held in numerous public collections, and this latest exhibition for the Flowers Gallery in London on the somewhat infamous Cork Street stretch draws on the dominance of Middle Eastern affairs in the media. Over the two floors of the Mayfair Gallery hangs 3 years' work, depicting chaotic crowds of suited bodies, blurred faces and grimacing smiles, as well as the politically focused Windsor knotted red tie. With titles such as Small Perfect Explosion and Contentious Return of Abdelbaset al-Megrahi, they resonate with the headlines we have come to see splashed across the newspapers in recent years.
I suppose it's just work from the last 3 years. It's not a kind of cohesive theme to it. It's, I'd say, the way I put it, it's more of kind of a common thread. And the common thread, I suppose, is the Middle East, in a sense. Many of the paintings are to do with Tony Blair and his appearance at the Chilcot Inquiry into the war on Iraq. Others address things like the demonstrations in Tahrir Square in Cairo and others still address issues like collateral killings. Whilst much of my source, I suppose, comes from similar sources to that which a journalist may use, I have an entirely different agenda. Journalists, of course, have a deadline to meet. It's about conveying information, reporting, and so on and so forth. Whereas I'm hopefully reflecting on something that has hopefully more longevity in a way, that addresses similar issues, but it is subjective. I'm not just conveying information, and I'm also making, let it not be forgotten, I'm actually making paintings, and the painting process is important to me.
Although much of the work is based on the prevalence of the Chilcot inquiry, Keane is insistent that this is very much a starting point. As journalism comes under fire as a medium for disillusion as well as truth, art seems to fill the somewhat hazy gap between the two, not only as a visual stimulus, but as a method of documenting the world around us.
I was travelling in Syria about 2.5 years ago, and as I was driving up the road, I came across, there were signs to Damascus, and I loved the sort of biblical significance of the road to Damascus and the fact there's a kind of modern motorway-type signpost to Damascus. But also on these signs, there were also signs to Iraq, and there was a kind of resonance there that sort of somehow demanded to be used. And when I got back to London in the studio, I was sort of addressing the issue of somehow the image of Tony Blair insinuated himself into this landscape. Chilcot inquiry into the war in Iraq was just happening at the time. Actually, it was just after I'd completed that first painting. And I watched that and became completely transfixed with his appearance and started taking screen grabs. And a lot of the work I do begins on a computer now, and I use sort of manipulated computer images and distortions and so on and so forth. Obviously with the view that ultimately it will be transcribed somehow into paint. So I'm sort of, that is sort of informed by that in the back of my mind, that this will become a painting.
With the prevalence of the internet in our lives and the ease in which words and pictures are shared and assimilated, Keane harnesses throwaway images and wrestles with them on a canvas. With thick palette knife smears and clear paintbrush dexterity, these are not just reproductions of war photography.
The title of the show is called Scratching the Surface, Joining the Dots. I was actually struggling for a title, and then this sort of came to me. I mean, there are obviously double meanings are intended, scratching the surface. Scratching the surface obviously implies, in its metaphorical sense, trying to get underneath the surface to understand a subject, which is obviously what I'm trying to do. But it also has a sort of kind of physical meaning as well of the surface of the painting that you are sort of scratching around in pigment on canvas. And then joining the dots again, it has both a kind of drawing reference and also trying to, as it, in its modern metaphorical context, is trying to make sense of all the bits and pieces. So, I mean, it's what I'm trying to do both in the graphic sense of working on a surface, but also in a kind of intellectual sense of trying to understand the subject that I'm dealing with. And then I begin this process of transcribing it into paint on canvas. And then it becomes a kind of painterly tactile. I'm using quite coarse canvas some of the time, thick paint. And so it's important that the surface of the painting has a kind of primal quality.
As a subject matter, the Middle East has nothing if not scope for comment. There is an abundance of images to decipher, potholes to stumble into, and conflicting scenarios to make sense of, as well as the seen it before factor to deal with. However, as an artist, there seems to be space where Keane can grab these saturated images and manipulate them in such a way as to speak of wider grand narratives. In this show, John Keane attempts to confront us with the big picture, literally, and by blurring these boundaries between art and war commentary, these suited figures in desert lands take on a different and perhaps more interesting role.
What I'm trying to do, both in the graphic sense of working on the surface, but also in a kind of intellectual sense of trying to understand the subject that I'm dealing with.
In London, for Monocle, I'm Jack Phillips.
And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. I'll be back in 3 hours' time at 2200 hours, when I'll be joined by Andrew Muller for the Monocle Daily. In the meantime, today's Midori House was produced by Paul Noble. The researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and the studio manager was Andrew Carter. That's all from us on Midori House. Bye-bye.